Evening, everyone. So welcome, Graham.
Thank you.
And we're looking forward to our studies tonight about Solomon. So that should be great. Now we're going to read from 1 Kings 2. All right, so that's good. Thanks, Graham. And Graham's going to let him jump into it, eh?
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you for just allowing my lateness there. I apologise. Tim probably told me that it was 7:30, but it just must have gone. Maureen says that she forgot, but I'm sure she didn't, really. So my apologies, but we're here. And we're just doing two nights on the early life of Solomon. So we're not going to cover the whole of Solomon's life. We could do a little overview and a little snapshot, but I wanted to sort of dig a little bit deeper into his early life. So we're going to start our first class tonight looking at chapter 1 and 2 of 1 Kings, and then in a fortnight's time, God willing, we'll have a look at chapter 3 and particularly focus on his wisdom and how he revealed that. So we're going to talk about tonight the establishment of Solomon. So David had, of course, finally become king of Judah and Jerusalem. He'd brought the ark to Zion. We know that from 2 Samuel 6. And he wanted to build God a house, didn't he? And God has some very interesting things to tell him about that. And he says, look, it's not going to be your job to build me that house. I'm going to build you a house, David. And he promises him a unique son and dynasty and promises victory over his enemies, which would bring this peace, a time of peace, prosperity to the nation. And a period of unprecedented wealth, really, and that's spoken about in 2 Samuel 8. Now, I just want to come over to Chronicles, because we know this 2 Samuel 7 record. I just want to come over to the 1 Chronicles record, which we don't always go to as often, and have a look in 1 Chronicles chapter 22, because what's interesting here is there's just a little bit of extra detail that hints at the great repercussions that were going to come upon David's family because of Solomon. Now, just have a look at 1 Chronicles chapter 22, and we're going to pick it up from verse 6, because what happens here is that David calls Solomon to him, and he charges him to build the house. And then he recounts what God said to him about that great promise, the Davidic promise. So here we are now in verse 7 of 1 Chronicles 22. And David said to Solomon, my son, as for me, it was in my mind to build an house unto the name of Yahweh my God. But the word of Yahweh came to me saying, thou hast shed blood abundantly and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build an house unto my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies round about, for his name shall be Solomon. Now we're not told that in the Samuel record. So here when David is given this promise, he's not only told that he's going to have a special son, his son is named before his birth. Think of the repercussions of that. Because Solomon was not the firstborn son of Bathsheba and David. Think of that. So he's going to be called Solomon. Peaceable. And I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days. He, it says in verse 10, shall build an house for my name. And he shall be my son. And I will be his father. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. So in the first primary fulfillment of this prophecy, the son who was promised was Solomon. Undoubted. But he wasn't the fulfillment of that promise, because ultimately, as we know, it had to be the Lord Jesus Christ, who was the literal Son of God, who would be the literal King of Peace. And we just have to go through the prophets, don't we, Isaiah, just into the record in Luke where Gabriel speaks to Mary to see all those obvious connections. But in the first sense, it was Solomon, the man of rest and of peace. He was the man who was going to build. Interesting, of course, as we're going to see, that in fact the beginning of his reign was one of war and bloodshed. But let's just leave that aside at the moment. And he's going to establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Now, you just stop and think about the impact that had on David's older sons who had already been born. He already had a multitude of sons, including Absalom. And they're immediately told, sorry guys, you've missed out. You're not going to be king. It's going to be another child. Solomon is going to be his name. And here they are growing up now. A lot of these were older men at this point. They weren't little boys. And you know what kings were like and sons of kings were like. I mean, if you've read any of the histories of any of the European nations or even some of Shakespeare's plays, you know how sons treated their fathers when they were kings. You're not going to be a king, Absalom. Oh, aren't I? And it explains a lot of things that happen, doesn't it, when we understand that. So let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 11. Because this is where the story of Solomon really starts, isn't it? Here's David. His son is going to be a son of peace. David wasn't going to build the temple because he was a man of war. What was going on in 2 Kings chapter 11? Verse 1, it came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when kings went to war. So the man of war, the king of war, who should have been out warring, he was putting his feet up. He was relaxing, having a good time at the palace, while Joab was out leading his armies. And at the very time when, as the record says, he sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Raba. But, just don't miss those little words in the scriptures. But David tarried still at Jerusalem. You know, the record's almost saying he was the only man there. Now, we know that wasn't true, but the record's really emphasizing all the men of Israel out of battle, but not the man who should have been leading them. He's putting his feet out at Jerusalem. And what time is it? Verse 2. It's in the eventide, dusk, when darkness is gathering. It's the time of shadows. And the shadows are going over the light of David. Interesting, of course, that the kings of Israel were called the lamp or the light of Israel, isn't it? And here the lamp is being put under a bushel, as it were. It's being hidden away. And at that time he arose off his bed. And it would have been a lovely time of evening, I'm sure. You know that. I just love that evening time when the breeze just comes down from the hills and the light's just going down. You've got the beautiful colours. And it's just a lovely time of night. I quite often like going for a bit of a walk, as others do. And he just decided to get up, take in a breath of fresh air from the balcony. And as he's looking out, there's this innocent young lady. He's just gone outside to wash, as was their custom. You know, I have read some writers who paint Bathsheba as this almost floozy, who's flaunting herself. I don't believe that was the case. He was up in his palace. He was looking down. She was in her backyard, trying to just wash, as was their custom. And he's looking down over the top, the only man, as it were, in the city. And from the roof, notice that verse 2, and from the roof he saw her. What were Israelites supposed to do on the roof? Pray. Because every house of Israel was patterned on the altar of incense. You know that the name used for the top of the altar of incense is the word that's used for the roof of the house. And that little paramount, that little battlement that goes around the roof that protects you, is the word used of that which went around the top of the altar of incense. Every house was to be a house of prayer. But David hadn't gone up there to pray, had he? Well, he had gone up there to pray, but not P-R-A-Y, P-R-E-Y. And he watches this woman, this beautiful woman, just washing herself. It's actually used in some places to cleanse from sin, the washing of sin. Now, there's all sorts of types that are there. But David just sees her beauty. Now, the Jews say there were three great beauties of the scriptures. Sarai, or Sarah, Esther, and Bathsheba. The most beautiful women that ever lived. I'm sure that Eve would be among that category. But the Jews tend to talk of those three women. And David looked with his eyes. And if there was one problem that David had and that he passed on to his children, it was women. Nothing wrong with women, sorry. Nothing wrong with women. It was what was wrong with was with how David looked upon them. And the tragedy that came into his house was passed on to his son. And his predilection for beautiful women was something that Solomon struggled with. And we'll touch on that next week in a positive sense as he began his reign, very positively. But tragically, he was drawn away, just as his father David was. So this wonderful woman Bathsheba, her name means the daughter of seven, or daughter of the oath. Seven is the number of the oath. Here's the daughter of the oath. And she was a wonderful woman. Personally, I think she was quite innocent in all this. You know, people say, oh, well, why didn't she scream out? Why? Who's going to stop the king? Even if she's calling out blue murder, who's going to bother to come in to stop the king have his way? And she may very well have called out, as was described under the law, if that circumstance happened to a woman. She may well have done that, but she wasn't heard by anyone except for God. And although he allowed certain tragic circumstances to come into her life, it was for a far greater outcome for that woman. And so David sends, of course, asks, who is it? Ah, it's Bathsheba, the daughter of the oath, the daughter of Eliam, whose name means God of the people, the wife, David, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. You know, we just got to read carefully to see the impact of this, don't we? And see what David's doing and what's going on. And this character tragically is passed on to his son. Now, David was a man after God's own heart. He was a lovely man, a wonderful man. But the beauty of the scriptures is we're not just given these men as idealistic people who we can never match up to. We're actually given examples and characters in the scriptures who make mistakes just like you and me, and often worse ones. I haven't personally committed adultery. I don't want to talk about that necessarily, but I haven't personally committed that sin. All right? But there's plenty of other sins that I've committed. All right? And we can learn from these examples of these great men who we look up to, and rightly so, but they're not perfect. There was only one perfect man, the greater son of David. And so he sends messengers. He took her, she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was purified from her uncleanness, which links back to why she may have been washing in the first place. And then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived. And here's the beginning of this family through the line of Bathsheba. Well, we know the story. I don't want to go into all the details. But just in summary, we know the result of David's sin reverberated through the nation. This brought disrepute upon the father and disrepute upon the nation who was supposed to manifest the father. And it had this great effect on David and his family. Just think about it. His first child with Bathsheba died. And it's just heartbreaking, isn't it, to read. David just throws himself at the mercy of God. He refuses to eat. He prostrates himself, praying like he'd never prayed before for this little one. And the little one still died. You know, that's one of the hardest things. I haven't experienced losing a child like that. Tragically, one of our ex-staff members lost a child this week. I just cannot imagine what that is like. You may have had some experience with that, and I apologise if this is, you know, dredging up some very deep-seated emotions for you. But there have been other things that have happened in our lives which we sometimes turn to God in prayer, and it's not disrespect, but it's, why? How can you let this happen? Where is the justice in this one who hasn't even had a chance of life? Why has this come into my life? I've dedicated my life to you. I've thrown all my energy and commitment into serving you, and yet you allow these things. And I don't know about you, but there have been times in my life when I've been in a dark place and I have actually questioned God. And there have been times when I haven't seen clearly God's purpose and why that would happen. And sometimes you wonder, why does that occur? And we don't have all the answers. I do know this one thing, though, is that as you come through the darkness out the other side, you do come to a realization that you're not in control. And the only one who is does make choices. He chooses whether he will intervene or not intervene. He chooses how he answers prayer. He will always answer prayer, always. It may not be the answer we want. Sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no, and sometimes it's just wait. And we're not always prepared for that, because at the time we want this problem fixed. We want this situation resolved. We want it fixed so we don't have to worry about it and carry around this burden anymore. But God turns to us and says, my grace is sufficient for thee. I don't know about you, brothers and sisters. There's many of you who are older than me. That is a bitter lesson to learn sometimes. And it takes a lot of patience and trust in God to say, you do know better than me. And the answers will come, because there's a far greater weight of glory, Paul says, that is awaiting us compared to any of those sorrows. But I just see David there in huge sorrow and grief. And then the message comes, your son's died. And he gets up and he washes himself and he eats and he gets back to work. Wow. What an amazing example that is. To not wallow in those emotions. to not allow you to be overcome by them, but to be strengthened through the Father, through the work of the Son in our lives and his angels, through the work of brothers and sisters that we allow into our lives to help us to see the light just flickering at the end of that dark tunnel that we're in, and to get through that experience and to be strengthened, even though at the time it felt like it was pummeling us to death and it was too much to bear. Well, that wasn't the end of his trial though, was it? He lost the respect of his greatest advisor, his dearest friend, his familiar, Bathsheba's grandfather, Ahithophel, the wise man who counseled the king in affairs of the state, turned his back on him because what he did to his granddaughter. Tragically, blood is sometimes thicker than water. It shouldn't be so, though. We've got to be big enough to forgive and to see God's purpose as more important than harm to personal family members or to yourself. Not only that, he lost the respect of his children, especially Absalom, who rebelled. Amnon slept with his half-sister Tamar, and then Ahithophel turned around and killed him. And David lost the respect of his nephews as a result of this, especially Joab. Oh, you come here, David. Go on, you come and do this job. See how long you last. Oh, you're too hard for me, he says, you sons of Zeruiah. Because he lost their respect. The repercussions of this resounded through. And when Absalom came to power, he said, David, you want to sleep around with people? I'll show you sleeping around. And he took his concubines out on the top of the house and had his way with them there in front of all the people. That's what I think of you, mate, he says to his dad. And through all this, David's heart was still God's heart. How did it break that heart to see that happen? All of this is vital to understanding Solomon. So eventually this terrible grief turned to great joy, didn't it? Come over to 2 Samuel chapter 12. This lovely time when at last this child was born. And we pick up the record in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 24. David comforted Bathsheba his wife. He went in unto her and lay with her, and she bare a son, and he called his name Solomon, peaceable. And Yahweh loved him. What a wonderful thing. But you know what, brothers and sisters? Solomon was not the next son in chronology at all. Come over to 1 Chronicles chapter 3. See, the record reads as if they had the child died, and then everything's great, and they conceive again, and they have a child. It's not what happened. Have a look. Oh, not the whole story of what happened, I should say. Yes, it did happen, but it didn't happen as nicely as that. Come over to 1 Chronicles chapter 3. And here we pick up the record of the sons. You see what we're talking about. David had already had all these sons. Just look at them in chapter 3 of 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles 3 verse 1. These were the sons of David which were born him in Hebron. The firstborn, Amnon of Ahinoam the Jezreelite. The second, Daniel of Abigail. The third, Absalom the son of Maacah. The fourth, Adonijah the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah of Abital. The sixth, Ithream by Eglah. These six were born in Hebron. He had six boys who were grown up, most of them, to be men by the time that he received the promise of this boy, Solomon. Well, Solomon was going to be next. Well, let's have a look. Verse 5. These were born unto him in Jerusalem. Shimeah. And Shobab. And Nathan. And finally, Solomon. Four. And he was the fourth of Bathsheba or Bathsheba. What an amazing thing. There are three sons born after the events of 2 Samuel chapter 12, before Solomon's born. What a staggering thing. And just listen to their names. Shimeah means rumours. How many rumours were flying about the palace, do you reckon? About all of this. And is this the promised son? No, because he's not called Solomon. And then they have Shobab. Well, Shobab means rebellious or falling away. Was that bitter disappointment? Was he a bitter disappointment to his family? Or were the other sons bitterly disappointed and had fallen away from the king? Well, the next son, Nathan, means gift. Maybe David and Bathsheba had finally learned to trust. God will give his gift in his good time. We'll have Solomon. He'll come. He'll be the next in line. Hasn't come straight away. Isn't that remarkable how God does that? You know, I'm going to fix this up. David, you're going to have a son. He's going to be Solomon. He's going to establish a kingdom. And then the thing happens with Bathsheba. And then all these things start happening in his family. The child dies. Then they have another child. No, it's not the one. Then they have another child. No, that's not that. I wonder whether there was angelic visitations to them to say, no, this isn't the one. This is so-and-so. And by the time they get to Nathan, their third son in this time of their life, God will give his gift when he's ready. And as soon as they threw themselves into the hand of God, what happened? Along comes Solomon. What a wonderful lesson, brothers and sisters, that we can't choose when we think God should act in our life. And he doesn't always do what we think he should do at the time that we want it to be done. What he wants us to do is to say, God, you are right. No matter what happens in my life, no matter what tragedy, no matter what difficulty, you are right. I'm not going to challenge you. I'm not going to question you. I'm going to trust in you. I'm going to believe in you. Because you're going to send your son. He's going to establish your kingdom. And in your grace, we're going to be there. What happens along the way is to help that occur. So I'm going to trust in you that this is what I need at this moment. It's really hard to do when you've got to make decisions, though. What will I do now? Will I go this way? Will I do that? How will this work? And it's a bit like this. You know, you go in here, you come to a fork in the road. Oh, I'll go that way. And suddenly God puts a roadblock. Suddenly there's workers there, so you've got to turn around. Oh, I've got to go this way. Down you go this way. And you come to another fork in the road. Oh, I'm going to go this way. Oh, yeah, that's right. Come along, speedy. That's great. Then you come to another fork in the road. Oh, this way. There's the roads clash. Okay. Yeah, no, we want to go. And that's what God does in our lives. And the angels are working overtime. And when we come to those catastrophic moments in our lives, we throw our hands up and say, oh, no, God, what are you doing? He's just saying, well, you just made the wrong choice. I'm just showing you the right way. Why are you angry about that? I'm a loving father. You made that choice. I'm just helping you make the right one. And this is what David had to learn and what David passed on to his son. And so finally the fourth son was born. We come back to 2 Samuel again in chapter 12. Look at how God names this boy. David called him peaceable because of that whole message that he received from God that he was going to be king of rest. He was going to bring peace. But in 2 Samuel chapter 12, God says, well, I'm not going to call him peaceable. verse 25, God, who loved him, it says at the end of verse 24, God sent in verse 25 by the hand of Nathan the prophet. Isn't it interesting that Nathan sent the gift, the one given of God, who is the namesake of the previous son that was born to Bathsheba and to David. And Nathan comes and he says, God has called his name Jedidiah, loved of Yah. God loved him. Because he looked at that boy and he saw the one who was going to bring about the change. David called him peaceful. Yahweh says, no. He's loved of Yah. And David's name means the beloved. And although he was going to be like his father in that unfortunate side of his character, he was also like his father in that he loved Yahweh. And I've read all sorts of things about Solomon, you know, that he really got things wrong, and that it's almost as if he wouldn't even be in the kingdom. He's not a type of Christ. In fact, when people come to the Song of Solomon, they make up all sorts of stories about this Solomon, who is this despicable king who steals away the real love from the shepherd boy. That's rubbish. I'm sorry. You may think that that's true. For my personal opinion, that's rubbish. That's not what Song of Solomon is about. And in Song of Solomon, Solomon is established as the rightful king, the type of the Lord Jesus Christ who would gather his Jew and Gentile bride together. And it's based clearly on the words of Solomon in Psalm 45, which was utilized by Hezekiah, who also collated the Song of Songs. And those two kings, Solomon with his marriage to the daughter of Pharaoh, we'll talk about that next class, Hezekiah and his marriage to Hephzibah, were typing the joining of the Jews and Gentiles in the hope of Israel. And so here's this lovely man, this lovely son who's now born. And the past 6 years, this was 6 years. 6 years. You know, we read that record, it's like, you know, they sin, oh, the child dies, and then they have Solomon. It was 6 years that passed as these other sons were born. And those 6 years of pain are now suddenly gone. God's forgiven David his sin. He's accepting of David and Bathsheba's relationship. And out of their union came the promised seed, despite all those other things that happened. Now, what was it like for Solomon as he grew up? We're not told a lot, but we are told one thing. Let's come over to 1 Chronicles for a moment, chapter 27. Often when you're looking at some of these Bible characters, you do have to sort of do a bit of digging and look at some obscure passages just to see, you know, what it was like and to draw out of the record. This is just a throwaway comment, but I think it's quite interesting when we read it. 1 Chronicles chapter 27. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 27, we're talking about the king's overseers, the people who looked after all the different works. And you've got people who looked after the camels, you've got people who looked after the vineyards, you've got people who looked after the olive trees, all these people responsible for different things. And when we come to verse 32, this is very interesting. 1 Chronicles 27, verse 32. Also, Jonathan, David's uncle, was a counselor, a wise man, and a scribe. And Jehiel, the son of Hachmoni, was with the king's sons. And it means he took care of and tutored the king's sons. That's the implication. Literally means to take care of. But the idea is here he is bringing up the king's sons. Who was the king's son at this point? Well, it was Solomon. And here's this man who's brought into the house. He was most likely one of the sons of Korah. We don't have time to look at all this, but 1 Chronicles 15, verse 18 and 20, just compare some of the passages. It's likely that he was one of the sons of Korah. those wonderful priests who were responsible for the door of the house to keep pure doctrine, they're the ones who are teaching the king's son. What a lovely thing that is. And both David and Bathsheba must have taken great care with his upbringing. Come over to Proverbs chapter 4. This is the lovely thing about Proverbs, because it actually gives an insight into how Solomon was brought up. You see, chapter 4 of Proverbs, for example, is actually Solomon's recollections of what David taught him as a boy. Just look at it in chapter 4 of Proverbs, verse 1. The first 9 verses here, here's David the father teaching Solomon his son. And in verse 1 it says, "Hear ye children the instruction of a father." Here's David talking to Solomon. And he's saying, this is how you can actually be instructed in wisdom. This is how you can develop true understanding and good doctrine so you will not forsake the law. And this is where Solomon says, well, I was my father's son. Tender and only beloved in the sight of my mother, he says in verse 3. See, he was the special boy, wasn't he? The one they waited for, the one that they experienced so much tragedy for. And he was brought into their lives. He taught me also, he says in verse 4. He said unto me, let thine heart retain my words. Keep my commandments and live. Get wisdom. Get understanding. Forget it not, neither decline from the words of thy mouth. So yes, we know that Solomon chose wisdom. We'll look at that next week. Next class. We know he chose that. Why did he choose it? Because he had a wise father who taught him the importance of it. We live in an age, brothers and sisters, that is absolutely ridiculous. And it doesn't know how ridiculous it is. It thinks it's so smart. It's so clever. It's so mature. And it is ridiculous. It is a joke. And you see the way people act. You have 38-year-olds who are out doing ridiculous things, who have never grown up. You know, by that stage, my kids were almost teenagers. I just had to think for a minute there. They were basically teenagers by that stage. And people in this life seem to think, we've got to live it up, enjoy life, you know, go and experience all the thrills, and then when you're, you know, in your late 30s and 40s, settle down, have some kids, and, you know, never see your grandkids, tragically. It's just ridiculous what this world thinks is amusing. I am not on Facebook. Look, nothing against anyone who uses Facebook. My wife uses Facebook for some really helpful things because she can't always get out to things. She can't always keep in contact with people. And Facebook's really helpful for that. But can I just tell you, can I just say that the amount of drivel which is used on Facebook is deplorable. I'm really sorry. And I'm really happy for you to use Facebook for really useful things. I think that's great. And there are lots of useful things you can use it for. Technology of itself is not wrong or bad or evil. It's how we use it. But can I say... No, I won't go. I'll get off my soapbox. But honestly, there are far more valuable things we could be doing with our time. Certainly use the tool, use it wisely. And there are many places and organisations that do. Right? Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Facebook of itself is... shouldn't be used or is wrong. I'm not saying that. But I think that sometimes we in our silliness get carried away and waste a whole lot of time we don't need to on stuff that just doesn't matter. And David says, don't be fooled by that. You know, don't forsake that wisdom, because that wisdom only comes from here, brothers and sisters. You're not going to find it anywhere else. That wisdom is what's going to preserve you and protect you. All right. So I'm not bagging things just for the sake of it. I'm just saying let's think about it and let's see what's important and then act upon that. And so over in verse 10 he says, well, hear, O my son. And he begins another section to verse 19 of the importance of personal example. He says, hear, O my son, receive my sayings, and the years of your life will be many. Now, David's example wasn't always perfect. We've just seen that. But there were many things in his life which were. And tragically, there have been times where I've had to say, not in so many words, but to my children, look, do what I say, not what I do. Because the reality is that God's right and we don't always get it right. And our kids look at us and they'll often hear what the words are coming out of our mouth, but it's completely overwhelmed by what they see. And we've just got to remind them, look, I'm not perfect. We're going to make mistakes. So when I do the wrong thing, don't think that's an excuse for you to copy that bad example. You know, look at what the Lord Jesus Christ did. Look at his example. He was perfect. Try to live up to that. Listen to the words. Follow that and I'll do the best I can to give the example. Well, over in verse 20 he says, my son, and this is the third section of this chapter, verses 20 to 27, the importance of these sayings for life. He says, my son, attend to my words, incline thine ear unto my sayings, let them not depart from thine eyes, keep them in the midst of thine heart, for they are life unto those that find them, and health to all their flesh. Keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Put away from thee a froward mouth and perverse lips. Put far from thee. Let thine eyes look right on. Don't get distracted by everything and all the flashing bright lights and all the things around you. Let your eyelids look straight before thee. Ponder the path thy feet and let thy ways be established. Oh, I've just got to stop on that verse. There are some verses which it really pays to break down into the original language. I love Greek and Hebrew and finding out stuff, and I know that that's not everyone's cup of tea, but there are some things which you just got to break down. Ponder means to roll flat a road. It's the word the Hebrews use for rolling flat a road. That's what it means. Roll flat a road. Well, what road? Well, it's the path. That word path isn't just a wandering path. It literally means a circular path. We're talking about eternity here, brothers and sisters. This is the path of eternal life. So roll flat the road of the circular track or path of your feet. Because you've got to be walking on the way to eternal life. And let all your ways, that's the word derek, which means a well-trodden road of the course of your life. So roll it flat, this way to the kingdom. Make sure that it's well-trodden and it becomes the course of your life. Let it be established. Set up. Erected, firm and strong, immovable. Turn not to the right hand nor to the left. Remove thy foot from evil. What an amazing privilege Solomon had to be brought up at the foot of the king. Well, we're going to move through pretty quickly. I apologise that we started late, but can I just go a bit longer? Is that all right? You all right if we keep going? Because it's actually probably where we'd normally finish. But if you don't mind, can we just go a bit? All right. So Bathsheba, here she is as the kingmaker. We'll just wander back to 1 Kings chapter 1 and 2 and we'll just glide over some of this. Bathsheba besought David on behalf of Solomon after Adonijah set himself up as king. We just pick up the record at 1 Kings chapter 1. David, of course, was old. He was stricken in years. He was going to die. Of course, they had Abishag, the Shunammite, come. There wasn't long to go. This was the last year of his life. According to my reckoning, it's BC 964. The last year of David's life. There wasn't too long to go. And he says in verse 5, and Adonijah the son of Haggith exalted himself, saying, I will be king. Which is funny because his name means the Lord is Yah. And that was the great mystery of the kingdom of Israel. The kingdom of Israel was the kingdom of God on earth, and the king was Yahweh. They just happened to be caretakers. But Adonijah didn't understand that. No, I'll be king, he says. And he prepared him chariots and horsemen. What did the law say about horses to the kings? What did the kings have to write out from the law? Don't gather to yourselves horses. And he had 50 men to run before him. Why? Why did he so quickly think that he was the one? Verse 6, his father had not displeased him at any time, saying, why did you do that, son? He never picked him up for his sins. He never questioned him about the irreparable things that he did. He just let it go. It was easier to keep the peace. Don't rock the boat. Our family's a disaster zone anyway. I don't want to make any more trouble. That is not good parenting. And I know I'm not an expert. I've been an educator for 30 years. I had brought up two kids myself, and they haven't been perfect by any stretch of the imagination. So don't get me wrong, I'm not setting myself up here as the paragon of virtue, but I can tell you this, if you let your kids get away with it, they'll never learn. And I know that some of our parents sometimes at school are a little bit worried that sometimes we're a bit tough on the kids. Well, the reason why we're tough on them is because we love them and we know that principle. And the reason why we're tough on our own children, personal children, is because we love them. That's why God chastises us. If he didn't love us, he'd let us run rampant. He wouldn't care. But because he does care, he says, whack, wake up to yourself. And I hate to say it, but some of our kids could do with a bit of a pat on the back, a bit lower and harder. I'm sorry. That is just a fact. Now, I am all for encouragement. Don't get me wrong. We have got to encourage our kids. And traditionally, kids have not been encouraged enough. But you don't stop disciplining when you give encouragement. The two go hand in hand. You love them, so build them up, encourage them. But if they're going in the wrong way, for their sake, you've got to stop them. I mean, if I was on a way towards desolation, death and just the end of things, I would hope that someone in my ecclesia or in my family would stop me and say, Graham, what are you doing? Where are you going? Why are you making those decisions? Have you thought about the repercussion of that? We love you. We want you in the kingdom. The two go hand in hand. Let's encourage, but let's be honest. And David didn't. And he lost his sons. Think about how many he lost. Because he never displeased them by saying, what are you doing, son? And it was tragic. And it took Nathan the prophet to come alongside that wonderful woman, Bathsheba, and say, Bathsheba, he's not going to do it. He's not going to be able to do it without your help. We're going to have to get in there and help him out. Otherwise, things are going to go pear-shaped very quickly. Tell you what, Bathsheba, you go in first. You let him know what's happening. And as you're talking, I'm going to come in. This was a planned attack for the benefit of the kingdom. Yeah, you might think, oh, it's a bit sneaky, a bit underhanded. No, it wasn't. They saw the desperate need to bring about change in the nation. They knew that Yahweh had said who it would be. It would not be Adonijah, it would be Solomon. They were acting on Yahweh's behalf. And this is the other thing. When I was talking about the importance of letting God act in your life, the only way God can act on your life is by you acting. Because he acts through you. So yes, you throw your life in the hands of God, and then you do something about it. And if you make a mistake, he'll show you we went the wrong way. He'll set up a roadblock. He'll cave the road in. Don't worry. Do something, but do it in faith, believing in him. And that's what these two went. And in verse 15, Bathsheba, the daughter of the oath, went into the king to the chamber, and she bowed herself. Look at the attitude that she had. She knew she had to act, but she did it in the right way. Verse 16, she bowed. She did obeisance to the king. And so the king responded. And she said, look, you know, David, Solomon, thy son, will reign after me. You know that's what Yahweh said. He'll sit upon the throne. But now Adonijah's standing up and saying he's doing it. You have to act. And lo, verse 22, while she yet talked with the king, Nathan the prophet came in. And he said, you know what's happening, don't you, king? Everyone's following after Adonijah. And because of that, David acted. He woke up. He realized what was going on. In verse 28, he called Bathsheba. And he said in verse 30, I swear unto you by Yahweh God of Israel, assuredly Solomon thy son shall reign after me. He will sit upon my throne in my stead. I'm going to do it this day. And he set up the king and Solomon was crowned. Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet was anointed at the Gihon spring. It means the bursting forth, the gushing. And it was the very spot. We won't go there, but Isaiah 7, you know it. Where the prophet Isaiah, the salvation of Yahweh, carrying his son, Shear Jashub, the remnant shall return, went to evil King Ahaz, who was trying to bring about his own salvation, and said, seek a sign, Ahaz, ask a sign. And Ahaz in his vanity said, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. I won't tempt Yahweh. Oh, boy. And Isaiah says, well, I'm going to give you a sign. Here it is. Behold, at the virgin's fountain, the virgin will conceive and bear a son. You know who stood at that exact spot? Only about 30 years later, Rabshakeh, outside the city walls, saying, who's going to save you? Where's your king? Where's this boy who was born? Because Hezekiah was initially the primary fulfillment of that prophecy. Where's the boy? The one promised. Where is he? He's sick, isn't he? What can he do? And Hezekiah told the people, don't say a word. Why not? Because they threw themselves at the mercy of their God. And what did God do? He sent his angel that night, and in the morning they're all dead men. Love that. That's the virgin's fountain. And there was that tunnel. This is where they stood outside the Gihon spring. They built that tunnel, bringing the outside water source, which they knew was going to be devastated. If they didn't do something, they built around it. They put towers over it. They dug the tunnel and they brought the waters into the pool. Of Siloam. We don't have time to follow through the beauty of that. And so, the spring of the steps was there as a symbol that Yahweh's promises of the king will never fail. That's why they anointed him there. He was the promised king, and those promises would never fail. There was a lot more I wanted to talk about, but we'll leave it there. We didn't even get to chapter 2, did we? But I think you can read the story for yourself. I hope that you've found that interesting, brothers and sisters, and we've learned some lessons. And next class, we're going to pick it up in chapter 3 as we see Solomon the king beginning his reign with a wonderful choice to be wise, like his father David had instructed him.